The man whom James Darkwood had replaced at Plant 234, Wilbur Nash, was a quality control inspector, which made it all the easier for Darkwood to move about the plant without attracting undue attention. A quality control inspector went about inspecting for quality, and that meant looking over shoulders. There were, however, places within the plant that Nash, whom Darkwood impersonated, was not authorized to enter. Only the highest grades of security clearance were given admission there, and then only as required. These were the places to which James Darkwood most earnestly required access. These were the chemical mixing rooms. It was further to Darkwood's advantage that he only needed to rely on the efficacy of the makeup with which he disguised his appearance up to a certain point, the makeup enabling him to make a near-perfect match to Wilbur Nash for the initial entry to the plant. After passing through a robing station barely 50 feet inside the plant entrance, all personnel here wore protective clothing which covered them from head to toe, this over their regular outer garments. The tricky part, if James Darkwood survived that long, would be leaving the plant, because although the original facial similarity to Wilbur Nash was strong, they were nothing alike in body shape, and Darkwood was taller. Again, he would be relying on the average person's lack of recognition of detail. If he was expected to be Wilbur Nash, people would see him as Wilbur Nash, unless something occurred to cause them to view him differently. If someone who knew Nash intimately saw James Darkwood, the game would be up. But Darkwood's immediate concern occupied most of his thoughts for now, and that was how to gain access to the chemical mixing rooms without raising some sort of alarm. And try as he might, he could think of no way of doing that. But access had to be gained. An entire Allied fighter group stood by, waiting for the data Darkwood could only learn by entering one of the mixing rooms. If biological agents were being produced there to be born in chemical weapons, then Plant 234 had to be bombed out of existence. But if they were not, the potential cost to the fighter group from Eden City's state-of-the-art anti-aircraft defenses could not be justified. For more than a year, there had been cryptic suggestions in intelligence data that Eden scientists had discovered a way of combining chemical and biological warfare methodology in a way never before attempted. Biowarfare, historically, was inefficient in the airborne context, with the potential for either covering vast and unpredictable expanses on errant winds or settling almost immediately to the ground. Furthermore, in the modern era, it was fast and relatively easy to produce massive quantities of inoculant against a specific disease or combination of diseases. The frightening potential, if Eden possessed the rumored technology, was that chemical carriers would support the biological agent, releasing it in timed doses, and over this period of time, the chemical carrier would act upon the biological agent, mutating it in unpredictable variations which could not be inoculated against. Some of the chemical carriers were lighter than air, hence would remain airborne for a considerably longer period of time, while some were comprised of heavier elements and would immediately fall to Earth, hence again the unpredictability. Such a biowarfare attack could not effectively be fought, so it had to be countered before it was launched. Yet the compound in which Plant 234 was set was placed in the center of one of Eden City's poorest and most populated areas. Precision hits would be required to prevent an attack on the plant from turning into a bloodbath of the innocent. Throughout the first half of Wilbur Nash's shift, James Darkwood went about the mechanics of Nash's job, at the same time trying to discern what bits and snatches of useful intelligence data he could, but his thoughts were chiefly focused on what he should do. By the time the lunch break came, he had made up his mind. Almost everyone at the airport was armed, it seemed, the private citizens with handguns discreetly holstered at their sides or poorly disguised beneath shirts left out of the trousers, the security personnel with energy rifles slung under their arms and Lancer 9mm caseless pistols, or the somewhat more cumbersome energy pistols in security holsters at their waists. Kronberg despised the American society which flowed around him. When citizens were armed, they were impossible to control. Superior military force could subdue them in large numbers, of course. Guns were no match for tanks and missiles and gunships, but as long as there were arms, there would be underground resistance attacking from within. All of the successful dictatorships of history had begun by disarming the citizenry. Such action was an indisputable prerequisite to subjugation. Kronberg walked on, eager to get away from the terminal to make his rendezvous. Over the last 48 hours, his own hand-picked team of SS personnel had infiltrated Hawaii singly or in pairs on a succession of commercial flights originating in Europe, 24 men in all. and the operation was totally sterile, unknown to the Wilhelm Doring unit, which was doubtless responsible for the massacre at the school, about which he'd heard while watching televised news broadcasts from Hawaii. It was also independent of the larger, less specialized commando teams which had already penetrated or soon would penetrate the islands. He called this specialized unit of 24 the Sigma Group. The task, for which he had quietly and hastily assembled them, was vital to the success of National Socialism. Rescue Martin Zimmer from Pearl Harbor Naval Base, then very quietly kill him. There was the possibility that Wilbur Nash might be missed at lunch, that he might habitually eat with a circle of friends, albeit Plant 234 did not seem much like a friendly place. On the other hand, in a short while, all ordinary plant routine would be disrupted. Then it wouldn't matter. The chemical mixing rooms were at the center of the plant structure, the building itself taking up two entire square blocks of Eden City, the roadway going around the facility. The building's shape, when seen in aerial photographs, was that of an impossibly large rectangle, flat-roofed and gray, like a depression in the ground on which the city itself was built, encircled on all sides by higher structures. To the north, those were the residential apartments where the higher-level employees, such as Wilbur Nash, lived. To the south, those structures were dormitories where the factory labor slept, showered, ate. It could hardly be called living. To the east were the loading docks, and beyond those, and a parking lot for trucks and cargo helicopters, was the perimeter. There was a fence 9 feet high and surmounted by razor wire. This fence contained the entire facility, which occupied, including Plant 234, four square blocks. And to the west lay the metal shops, the plastics facilities, and storage warehouses. Plant 234 built on one level only, at its highest point was perhaps 14 feet above the ground. Within the structure, there were tunnels rather than corridors, allowing workers and higher-level personnel to move from one area of the plant to another without having the slightest idea what went on around them. James Darkwood moved through one such tunnel now. There had been a guard at the end of the tunnel, armed only with an alarm device, weaponless. Darkwood, without a drug kit by means of which he could have rendered the man temporarily unconscious, was forced to kill the guard, rather than risk having the fellow awaken and alert plant security. Plant security personnel, dressed in voluminous black coveralls and black hooded face masks, were indeed armed. Supervisory personnel, as Darkwood pretended to be, wore white, while laborers wore blue. Prisoners were rumored to be used here as test subjects. Darkwood absently wondered what color they wore. Darkwood moved slowly along the tunnel toward Mixing Room 9, hot, perspiring inside his protective clothing, smelling his own body odor. Fear always smelled. At the midpoint of the tunnel, there was a ladder leading upward to a hatch, presumably set into the roof. Darkwood glanced behind him and ahead. There was no one in the tunnel, so he took the gamble. He climbed up the ladder as carefully as he could, considering the dim ambient lighting, inspecting the hatch for any signs of linkage to an alarm system. As best he could determine, there was nothing. The hatch gave without resistance. He let the hatch lower into position. Then Darkwood started down the ladder. Back into the tunnel, Darkwood walked on toward Mixing Room 9. The city of Honolulu was like a glittering jewel, new and shining under the afternoon sun. There were private automobiles everywhere, and the only personnel in military uniforms seemed obviously off duty. There was the occasional police car, the occasional remote video drone flying over the street to monitor for traffic accidents, but there was no security.
You know, considering that the Americans must know something of which Eden is about, I marvel that life merely goes on here.
The Untersturmführer, his name was Helmut Krauss, wheeled the electric car into a right turn off the boulevard along which they'd driven since leaving the airport and into a street with denser traffic.
It is like this everywhere, Herr Gruppenführer. We will crush them.
Yes, my young friend. But first, the matter for which we have all come here needs taking care of, does it not? Eden's leader and our inspiration must be freed from his jailers. Who knows what evil these Americans might plan for young Mr. Zimmer at the moment we attack?
Yes, Herr Gruppenführer, this is true.
You and your fellows have verified the details of the plan?
Yes, Herr Gruppenführer. The proper uniforms are secured, the vehicles, all is in readiness. Even as we drive to the temporary headquarters, the identity papers are being remanufactured so they will be fresh, not yet reported as stolen. We will strike Herr Gruppenführer tonight at the customary dinner hour for the personnel of the Pearl Harbor base.
It is good.
Driving gives me the creeps.
Tim Shaw spoke to his son, Ed.
Why? You taught me how to drive when I was a kid. You always said I was a good driver.
No, it's not the way you drive. It's what happened to the last person who drove me. Pull up over here.
Tim Shaw picked up a radio unit.
Give call sign. Leaving the car at 5th and Mauna Kea. Shaw and Shaw out.
Along Mauna Kea Drive, for a half mile in either direction from where they stood, was the immigrant section of Honolulu. A self-made ghetto. Most immigrants to the islands, and there were thousands of them each year, made a place for themselves, got decent jobs, good housing. But there were some, like the ones surrounding 5th and Mauna Kea, who brought their old lives in the reforestation camps of Brazil, in the tent villages of France, in the reactionist communities of Russia, and all the ills of everywhere else, and they lived the same way they always had.
So what are we looking for, Dad?
Russian guy by the name of Yuri. Runs designer drugs all along the Mauna Kea. He's half German, usually hangs out along Sugar Street.
Sugar Street was the toughest of the many neighborhoods along Mauna Kea. Tim Shaw opened the rear door.
Sure you want to go through with this, Mrs. Rubenstein?
You need a tourist, right?
Yeah, but if you get hurt, your father and your husband are going to be all over my ass. Excuse the language.
Annie Rubenstein stepped out of the car, pushing down her miniskirt. Angie Fargo got out on the other side of the car.
Hey, Angie, you keep this civilian out of trouble, huh?
Got it, Inspector.
You guys start walking, and at the first sign of trouble, just remember, I can almost hear you breathing.
Tim Shaw put the receiver into his left ear. He looked at Annie Rubenstein.
You remember one thing, Mrs. Rubenstein. This guy Yuri's a tough little shit. Mean. Wouldn't matter to him if he slit your throat to get $5, right? He's tight with the Nazis. He's an Eden agent, gotta be. Eden's his drug connection.
Then why haven't you arrested him?
Would you believe we've got nothing on him? Everybody knows he deals designer drugs. Everybody knows he deals information. It isn't like it was before the night of the war, where there's a law telling you how long you hold your breath and which way to fart, excuse the language. And these days it's basically the Constitution and a few laws to help implement things. But we still can't nail a guy because we think he's wrong. We still gotta have evidence.
So if he tries to rob us or something...
He's not gonna go for you, but whoever does will probably lead us to Yuri.
Then what? I mean, if you still can't arrest him.
Shaw smiled and pushed his coat aside so she could see the .45 tucked in his waistband.
This is an extraordinary situation, Mrs. Rubenstein. It requires extraordinary measures. Those Nazi creeps that killed all those kids can't be left hanging around to do more of the same. That's why Ed's with me. And Angie over there, her father and I were in the Marines together and used to work the streets together, too. She's a good guy. I figured you were a good guy, too. You know what I mean?
You're taking the law into your own hands?
Right, you are, little lady. Got any problems with that?
Not a one. My father always said the only real law is personal morality. With it, a code of laws is superfluous, and without it, a code of laws is a joke.
Your old man's got the ticket, Mrs. Rubenstein. Now be a good little tourist.
I like you.
I like you too. So don't go getting yourself killed or something, okay?
Wouldn't dream of it. Ready, Angie?
Ready, Annie.
Shaw watched as the two women walked along Mauna Kea toward Sugar Street, about 3 blocks down.
We're gonna get that Yuri bastard, Eddie. Make him tell us where those fucking Nazis that hit the school are hiding, and then maybe we'll have a moral dilemma.
A dilemma?
Yeah. A dilemma.
Darkwood stood outside the door to mixing room 9 for several minutes, listening. There were mechanical noises coming from beyond it. He could tell nothing else. Armed, not at all, James Darkwood had no choice but to open the door and hope he wouldn't walk into a black-clad security man with an energy weapon. The door was like a watertight doorway on a submarine. He spun the locking wheel. He stepped over the flange, a synth rubber gasket surrounding it, evidently to seal mixing room 9 in the event of contamination. Beyond the doorway was a narrow walkway extending in both directions, and beyond it, nothing. Darkwood stepped across the walkway to the railing and looked down. Contrary to all the intelligence data the Trans-Global Alliance had concerning Plant 234, the facility was not entirely on one level. Below Darkwood, stretching off well beyond the perimeter of the building, out to run beneath the loading and storage areas outside, was an assemblage of huge pressurized vats. Piping led from one to another and to storage tanks in the distance on either end. At the center of the area, almost just below him, were structures looking like hermetically sealed field accommodations or tents. But they were transparent, and there were men inside these, naked as Adam, except they were tied with hands behind them, and there were ball gags in their mouths. Some of the men just stood in the centers of the tents, while others threw themselves against the transparent walls, falling down, struggling to their feet, throwing themselves at the tent walls again. After a few seconds, the men started to collapse. These were test chambers, and the men inside the chambers were being used to gauge the effectiveness of Eden's biological weapons. Turning away from the rail, Darkwood saw a black-clad figure with an energy rifle coming toward him along the catwalk.
Who are you?
James Darkwood slumped against the still-open door.
Why is this door open? Answer me or you will be shot.
I took a wrong turn, man.
That is not the correct answer.
Maybe my suit has a hole in it. I feel sick, man. Maybe we're all contaminated.
The security guard took the one step Darkwood needed him to make, and James Darkwood threw his entire body weight against the door, swinging it hard against the face and upper body of the security man. Darkwood threw his left fist upward, then hammered downward for the guard's throat. Before he changed uniforms with the dead man, he would change faceplates in their masks. He started dragging the body off the catwalk, over the flange of the airtight doorway, and into the tunnel. Soon the man he'd killed at the entrance to the tunnel would be discovered, and the guards patrolling Mixing Room 9 might have to make regularly scheduled check-ins. All in all, time was running out. Granted, he already knew enough about Mixing Room 9 to recommend the airstrike against the facility, and if he had been the agent he should have been, he would have left immediately. But there was something else he'd seen below the catwalk. There was a pen on the far side of Mixing Room 9, like a large animal cage with shining metal bars that were probably electrified. Inside the cage were at least 24 bodies, crowded together, naked, no one touching the bars. They were the victims for the next test series. In a few minutes, or a few hours, it didn't matter really, a few of them would be taken out, tied and gagged, and put into the tents to die. James Darkwood had a duty more immediate than his report to consider. Even though most of the other women she saw, and Angie the policewoman too, were dressed in miniskirts and high-heeled plastic-looking boots, Annie Rourke Rubenstein still felt like a hooker in an old videotape. A thought suddenly crossed her mind as she and Angie navigated a narrow alleyway still one block away from Sugar Street.
Have you read anything about Lidvilded Island lately?
Lidvilded what land?
Lidvilded Island, Iceland, you know.
Oh, every once in a while there's something in the papers, I mean.
About women's fashions there?
No.
Well, I just couldn't imagine the women there dressing like this.
What's wrong with dressing like this?
Well, nothing, I guess. When we lived there, I used to wear these wonderful long skirts and these blouses with long puff sleeves and cuffs and necks up to here.
Annie started gesturing what she meant, but Angie was looking at her oddly.
Why would anybody want to dress like that?
Annie shut up and kept walking. She liked dressing that way. If Angie didn't...
Hey, look sharp, Annie.
Annie felt her eyes narrowing slightly as she followed Angie's gaze into a store window. The window displayed lingerie, and not the kind that a woman would buy for herself, she thought. Hot pink bras with black bullseye cutouts so the nipples could protrude, panties with fur trim and cutouts at the crotch. But reflected in the glass, she saw two men, staring at them, not the lingerie.
Think they work for this Yuri guy?
Doesn't matter. If they hit us, Tim and Ed will get them. And they're bound to know where Yuri is. Yuri's got his greasy little fingers in everything in this part of town. Keep walking, Annie.
Annie slipped her hand into her purse, cocked the hammer on the little Firestar 9mm, and raised the safety.
Don't jump the gun, Annie. Remember, we want to set them up so Tim and Ed catch them red-handed.
They can hear everything, right? Inspector Shaw and his son?
I sure hope so. Two of those guys we can handle. Around this part of town, they usually strike in large groups. These guys are probably just scouts for a gang. 6 or 8 guys, probably.
A gang. Wonderful!
Annie shook her head, walking on beside Angie, eyeing the two men who were quite definitely following them. She could see them every time a suitable piece of window glass was available. Annie Rubenstein and Angie reached the end of the block, Angie stopping to look into a shop window. A uniformed policeman walked past. Angie turned away.
He knows me. If he stops to say hello, we'll lose the guys tailing us.
There were magazines and books displayed in the window, all of the printing in Cyrillic alphabet and unreadable to her.
A Russian bookstore?
More or less.
Annie looked more closely. Interspersed among the books and magazines were a variety of items, some of which she recognized, others were objects she had not only never seen before, but couldn't guess at a use for.
Is this a...
Sexual aids, that's all. Welcome to Sugar Street.
Sugar Street.
The sidewalks were all but obscured by carts and booths, and the scruffy-looking men and scantily clad women who hovered about them, hawking their wares. Some of the stalls were apparently outgrowths of the stores they fronted, while others just occupied sidewalk space. And there wasn't much of that. The street was packed with gaily clad tourists weaving their way among the stalls, and persons whom Annie assumed were denizens of Sugar Street itself, men and women even more unsavory in physical appearance than those operating the sidewalk bazaar. There was two-way traffic on Sugar Street, but it moved very slowly because pedestrian traffic zigzagged and crisscrossed from one side of the street to the other. Annie wasn't certain what was going to happen, but she felt whatever it was would occur relatively quickly because as they entered Sugar Street, they picked up two more tales. Bending over a stall filled with tacky-looking shrunken heads made out of coconuts, she let her purse fall forward, pressing it against her naked abdomen as she picked up one of the coconut heads.
Isn't this cute?
When she looked at Angie, Angie looked back at her with an odd expression. As Annie put down the shrunken head and clasped both hands to her bag, her left hand flipped the catch on the flap. As she straightened up from looking into the stall, she drew the fire star with her right hand and slipped the cocked and locked pistol down into the waistband of her skirt. As she walked, holding her purse close against her, the purse obscured the portion of the gun sticking out over her waistband. As long as she kept her purse covering the area between her navel and her left hip bone, the gun wouldn't be seen. Annie walked on, four men following them now, two behind and one on either side of the street. The sounds, the smells, the press of people around her was almost overwhelming to her. But she was in it now, and there was no turning back. Energy rifles were peculiar devices, and objectively much more efficient than cartridge weapons. Despite that, James Darkwood would have much preferred his .45 automatic to the arm he now carried as he moved along the catwalk toward the nearest apparent means of descent to the lower level, a wide-treaded metal ladder. The ladder touched the floor about 25 yards from the presumably electrified holding pens where the human prisoners were held until their turn arrived to play laboratory test animals. There was one advantage to the energy rifle for which Darkwood was quite grateful. He could fire it into the circuit box that controlled the fence, and the electrical discharge from the plasma bolt would short the entire pen. Then he could free the prisoners. So far, he had seen no other black-garbed security personnel, but he knew that wouldn't last. And as he looked below him, he saw two. They waited, flanking the base of the ladder. But their weapons were still casually slung just like his, not at the ready.
Dave, where were you?
Darkwood presumed he was supposed to be Dave.
What took you so long?
Darkwood was nearly at the bottom of the ladder and nearly at the point where he'd have to commit to action one way or the other.
Well, funny thing happened.
Darkwood climbed down the rest of the ladder.
What the hell are you doing? Security has been breached, sir, but I'm on top of things. Stand back in case there's more trouble.
Three men not wearing white protective clothing emerged from beside the test tents and started toward him, one of them opening his suit and reaching under it. The other two men raised their hands.
You put men into those tents and then flood the tents with biological agents and you ask for mercy? You're nuts.
There were more men in motion, but not coming directly at him. Darkwood ran for the pen where the prisoners were kept.
Stay as far away as you can from the fence. I'm going to short it out, and that'll make an arc.
Darkwood stopped a few feet from the junction box.
Now don't look! Protect your eyes!
Darkwood approached the fence. Blue waves of electricity still moved across it, the prisoners within the enclosure huddling in fear. The frequency and apparent intensity of the energy discharges visibly diminished over the course of a few seconds. Darkwood's concentration already on the lock for the gate. If everyone within the enclosure had seemed in good shape, they could have climbed over the fence, but the people looked half-starved to death, and some of them had quite visible limb fractures and dislocations.
Stay away from this side of the fence. I'm going to shoot off the lock. Wait until I clear the charge.
He looked from side to side, found a piece of apparatus, perhaps something utilized in mixing the chemicals, he wasn't certain, but it looked like metal. Hefting it, there was enough weight. He hurled the object toward the fence. Darkwood ran to the gate, took a step back, and kicked at the gate.
Take these rifles. Use them. Get close from the ones who are going to kill you and meet me on the catwalk. Understand?
There were nods of assent. A naked woman, somewhere in her 20s, but exhausted and emaciated looking, her right shoulder severely dislocated, dropped to her knees at his feet, hugged her arms around his legs, and kissed his knees.
It's all right. No time for that. Come on.
Darkwood tossed one of the energy weapons to a man of about 50, but strongly set in his face and fit enough looking to be able to use it. He gave the second weapon to a man in his late teens. The two armed men flanking him, the rest of the freed prisoners around and behind them, Darkwood started toward the catwalk ladder. Some of the workers who tested the biowarfare materials, who mixed them, were running for the catwalk ladders themselves.
Remember, get clothing, you'll need it!
Darkwood reached the ladder. It was hard climbing that way, but he kept the rifle in his right fist and started up. They were two blocks into Sugar Street, the tourists fewer and fewer. The merchandise that was for sale in the grimy windowed shops and the precarious-looking stalls seemingly raunchier and raunchier. There was less vehicular traffic now, too, most of the cars having turned off Sugar Street at the intersection just past. Annie spotted two more men watching them, making for a total of six.
Just how close will Inspector Shaw and his son be, Angie?
Close enough, I hope.
They were directly opposite a small storefront, the windows filled with packing crates and grated over, the door open, a hot, musty smell emanating from inside. The two men Annie Rubinstein had just spotted started walking quickly toward them. Annie looked back. The man on the far side of the street was coming across. The three men behind them were closing up fast.
They're trying to herd us into the store.
Doesn't look like there's anybody inside, which probably means the place is loaded.
Angie made a great show of looking at the men, gesturing to Annie, then started a mincing run into the storefront. As soon as they were inside the store, Annie realized this had to be a mistake. There was the smell of body odor, dust, mildew. Two light fixtures only illuminated the entire length of the deep but narrow building, all the narrower seeming because of the boxes that were stacked floor to ceiling on both sides of them. The interior of the store was tailor-made for an ambush, a box canyon, but man-made.
Do you think those men who are so close behind us want to hurt us, Annie?
Could be. What a yucky-looking store, and right here in the middle of the block. You'd think they'd do something about it, whoever owned it. Let's see if we can find the owner.
The owner of the store? That's a good idea.
They were halfway along the store's length now, and as Annie looked back, she saw the six men from the street, two of them standing in the doorway, the other four walking after them.
Hey, Chicky. Want a party? You just want to give me all your money and jewelry and clothes. Maybe I don't touch you, huh?
As Annie looked ahead, she saw that Angie was stopped dead in her tracks, bare hands in the air. Annie sidestepped so she could look around Angie. Poking out from between two stacks of boxes was an energy rifle, a pair of enormous hands holding it, and a skinny upper body and animal-like face.
You bitches move, I'll blow your fucking heads right off! All I'd screw myself out is the earrings, and I can live with it!
This couldn't be part of Angie's plan, to have someone get the drop on her. Even if Inspector Shaw and his son arrived in only a minute, both of them could be dead by then.
Let go of the purse!
This purse?
Let go of the fucking purse!
So, I'll let go of the purse.
She let it fall away, twist-drawing the little fire star from inside the waistband of her skirt, wiping down the ambidextrous safety with her left thumb.
Hit the floor!
Tim Shaw heard the shot and kept running, his ear ringing with the sound. He glanced across the street. Ed was running diagonally from the corner, gesturing wildly with his left hand toward the storefront at the center of the block. Ed's .45 in his right hand.
Police! Out of the way, damn it!
Shaw's feet hammered the last few yards of pavement toward the storefront. He thumbed back the Colt's hammer. He saw a face peer out and pull back. As Shaw started to slow, two men darted from the front of the store, one of them holding an energy pistol, the other holding a knife. The one with the knife kept rabbiting into the street.
Eddie, grab the little bastard! Right! Got a shiv, be careful!
Shaw reached the storefront and dropped into a crouch, trying to take advantage of what little cover there was below the level of the plate glass and the gratings as he charged the doorway. He ran inside.
Police! Throw down your weapons, dammit!
Fuck you!
Tim, four guys in here! Got us pinned down, but we've got the back door cut off!
Fucking wonderful! We got him trapped! All right, you guys, listen up! can do this the easy way or the hard way. Don't mean shit to me. All I want is information. You give me what I want, you drop your weapons, you walk. You don't, you might die. What's it gonna be? I don't have all day, huh?
Yo, cop! Yo, shithead, what you want? What information you want?
I gotta talk with a schmuck by the name of Yuri. You know him?
Never heard of him.
Aw, gee, that's too bad, you know? Now I'm gonna have to kill all you guys, you know? What a bummer, huh?
Hey, Dad!
Tim Shaw shot a glance toward the doorway and the sound of the voice. Behind what little cover there was, he saw Ed, a .45 in his fist, his right knee on the neck of a guy who'd rabbited out of the store, the guy's hands cuffed behind him.
Way to go, Eddie. The reinforcements are here, guys. Start remembering Yuri or start getting whacked. What time you had just ran out.
What you want to know about Yuri, cop?
Oh, his favorite fragrance so I can buy him a gift, you asshole. Throw your piece out and get your buddies to do the same. Then stand up, hands up, and where I can see you guys. Then you tell me what I want to know. And you walk, not before.
Without exposing himself to hostile fire more than he had to, Shaw could see most of the corridor between the crates, almost all the way back to the rear of the store. He saw a gun, just a regular good old-fashioned gun and not an energy pistol, skate across the floor and come to a stop against a packing crate. Then there was another one, just like the first. Both Lancers, either stolen from an armory or from a well-off citizen. Punks like these didn't buy guns, at least not from legitimate gun shops. There came an energy pistol, then another energy pistol, and an Eden bayonet.
Step out with your hands up! Mrs. Rubenstein, Angie, keep them covered!
We got him, Tim!
Shaw could see the four men now, coming out, hands high over their heads. If he hadn't given his word, he would have popped them and rid the world of four scumbags. But he shrugged his shoulders and stepped into the little corridor between the boxes and crates, a handgun in each fist.
So before I get my part of this, tell me where to find Yuri. If you guys aren't making tracks before the uniform guys get here, there's no deal, so talk fast.
Yuri's over on Maui, man, with his little sister. She's real sick.
And you're giving me a line of shit, Junior.
Shaw walked up to the one who talked, a man of about 20 or so, his hair so greasy looking it shined, his trousers so tight they looked like they were spray painted on. Shaw laid the muzzle of the Smith & Wesson up against the man's right temple.
Play it straight and you walk. Lie to me, and if I don't catch it now and blow you away, I'll hunt you down and do it then. You can't hide from me. Not ever. Got it?
Yeah, I got it. All right.
Where's this Yuri? And just so we don't labor under any misapprehensions here, the Yuri I want is the guy who sells designer drugs and is all pals with the Nazis. That Yuri. Know him?
Yeah, man.
I'm old enough to be your father, God forbid. Don't call me man.
Yes, sir.
Better. Where's Yuri?
1322 Lanai Avenue, apartment 63.
Truth?
So help me, man. Sir.
One other little thing. This goes for all four of you guys, right? I ever catch you trying to muggin' again, you go down. Not to some luxury jail cell either. You go down 6 feet under good old Hawaiian soil. We understand each other?
Yes, sir.
Get into a job training program or something. Just get out of my life.
Shaw lowered the revolver and looked past the four toward Annie Rubenstein and Angie.
Okay with you girls, these guys split?
Whatever, Tim.
Step aside, ladies, and let these guys take a hike the back way. You guys want to do that?
Yes, sir.
Remember, let your conscience be your guides, and if you cross me, I'll kill you. Hit the fucking road.
The four started edging away. One of them started to reach for his gun, but not in any way that was threatening.
Be serious, huh?
Shaw backed toward the two women. There was a dead man with an energy rifle in his fists, nested in some of the boxes. Two neat bullet holes in him, one in the chest and one in the thorax.
Those shots are pretty close together. Microphone picked it up as one shot. Which one of you charming ladies,
Angie grinned and nodded her head toward Mrs. Rubenstein.
Angie, stay with Eddie and help him out. Mrs. Rubenstein, want to come with me to 1322 Lanai Apartment 63?
Ooh, I was hoping you'd ask. Shall we?
You realize you might be an accomplice to a killing?
A killing?
Well, Yuri isn't exactly your model citizen. And if I find out he knew about the school thing, well, he'd get a lawyer and eventually he'd walk because I don't have any probable cause.
Oh, then the law's as screwed up as my father said it used to be in the 20th century?
Oh, no. But some people get around to almost any law. Yuri's one of those guys.
The killing thing?
Yeah.
Only if you have to, huh?
Believe me, Mrs. Rubenstein, that's the only way it'll ever go down. And I like your style, lady.
From the top of the catwalk, James Darkwood saw the true meaning of the word revenge more graphically than he could ever have imagined it. The men and women whom he had liberated from the cage were killing everyone on the lower level, shooting them or bludgeoning them to death, ripping clothes from the bodies of the dead to cover their own nakedness, running on. Darkwood looked to the lower level only occasionally, his eyes and his weapon on the tunnel, waiting for the inevitable. He gave things another minute at the maximum.
Let's get out of here now! I'm leaving! Anybody who wants out with me comes now!
To the casual observer, Darkwood realized his actions in freeing these captives might have appeared to be altruistic in nature, but they were not. Quite selfishly, he wanted to free those people because it would make him feel good to do so. And any of these people he could get away with him might well provide highly valuable intelligence data concerning the experiments going on in Mixing Room 9 of Plant 234. Darkwood took one last look back. People were already starting up the ladder for the catwalk. Darkwood stepped into the tunnel, starting forward at a good pace, his energy rifle trained on the far end of the tunnel for that inevitable moment when the first security forces would come storming through. He was almost right under the overhead hatch leading to the roof when the door at the far end of the tunnel opened.
Up here! And hurry!
Darkwood started up through the hatchway, the escapees clambering up behind him.
They're coming!
Darkwood was onto the roof, no security personnel in sight.
Hurry it up! Take deep breaths and hold them until you're on the roof. They'll use gas.
Partially naked men and women were piling out of the hatchway, half crawling over one another. Darkwood pulled off his protective hood and the mask, throwing it away. The night air assaulting his nostrils, his lungs, making his blood rush with its cool freshness, giving him the sensation of lightheadedness. He stepped back, closed his eyes, tried adjusting to the lower light level. There was only one hope of getting out alive. That was to make it to the loading docks and steal a cargo helicopter.
About the last one?
Yeah! That's all of us!
You two guys, get the hatch closed and try to jam up the mechanism for the locking wheel. Buy us some time. You, with the rifle, stay with them just in case.
Darkwood looked around. Several more of the escapees had weapons they'd acquired in the lower level of Mixing Room 9.
Anybody with an energy weapon, stick close to me. We're going over to the edge of the roof. Any resistance we encounter near the loading docks, we have to take care of quickly. Then we're stealing a cargo chopper and flying out of here. Any questions?
You fly?
No, but I know how to run machines that do. Let's go!
James Darkwood started running in the direction of the loading docks. They encountered no resistance on the roof of Plant 234, but by the time they reached the west side of the structure, overlooking the loading docks and the parking area beyond, where the over-the-road transfer trucks and cargo helicopters were parked, there was considerable activity. Eden military police cars were in sight, converging on the complex. In no time at all, Darkwood realized there would be helicopters as well. Then his luck, which had been running rather well, and better than he had any right to expect, would run out. The cargo helicopters were slow, lumbering beasts to get airborne. Once airborne, because of the great engines required to handle the enormously heavy loads they usually carried, they maneuvered slowly, but they could cover straight-line distances quickly. There would be a chance, a very decent one, to escape. If, however, gunships closed in on the loading dock and parking area, one of the cargo choppers would never get airborne, and Darkwood and the men and women he'd freed would be doomed. There was no time left to consider alternatives or ponder his fate should he fail.
Follow me!
Darkwood clambered over the edge of the roof and dropped to the sloping roof, which covered the loading dock, skidding along its surface toward the roof of a cargo trailer. Darkwood hit the cargo trailer's roof hard, rolled, and caught his breath. Some of the freed prisoners were already following him. Darkwood hauled his energy rifle up on its sling as he climbed to his feet. Black uniformed plant security personnel turned their weapons toward him. Energy bolts impacted the roof of the truck, melting the plastic where the bolts struck. Darkwood jumped to the loading dock, locking the butt of his rifle into the jaw of one man, hammering the muzzle down over the skull of another. He stepped back, firing into a knot of men coming for him. Energy weapon fire came from the roof of the trailer, the older man whom Darkwood had armed cutting down some of the dock workers and security personnel.
Rally everybody and follow me to the choppers!
Right!
Darkwood ran. Two plant security personnel came up on his left. He ran on, nearing the far end of the parking lot. A military police car was driving toward him at high speed. Darkwood ran for the nearest of the cargo helicopters.
Please, God.
The machine wasn't locked.
Yeah!
He climbed up, looked aft, saw no one, went forward, dropping into the pilot's seat. The helicopter fuselage began to vibrate as he started the main rotor. He started the tail rotor then. Time was his greatest enemy. At any second, Eden gunships might close him off, or military police vehicles cross into the lot and open fire. As he looked through the windscreen, Darkwood could see his band of half-naked evacuees running, hobbling, some helping half-carry others, coming toward the machine. Gradually, only a little more quickly than he should, Darkwood started building RPMs. Oil pressure and temperature gauges were showing well, the ambient temperature outside in his favor there. At the far end of the parking lot, he saw a military police car, then another, then another. Shit. He couldn't get airborne yet, even if he tried, but he could move. Darkwood activated the controls, unchocking forward wheels, then aft, the chocks folding up into the wheel well housings. Oil pressure and temperature were rising. He checked pitch controls. He had full response. James Darkwood released the front and rear parking brakes and adjusted main rotor pitch, increasing tail rotor RPMs. The cargo helicopter started to move forward across the parking lot, not like an aircraft, but like some huge lumbering bus with undersized wheels instead. The military police cars were closing. Those few of the escapees who were armed opened fire on the vehicles, crippling one, but the others were still coming. Darkwood opened the port side vent window, shoving the energy rifle, which leaned beside him, through the open port. He was almost afraid to look up beyond the immediate area surrounding the craft, afraid that he might see gunships and it would all be finished. Behind him, he could hear the escapees clambering aboard.
Strap yourselves in. Keep that port side door open in case we have to fire.
All but five or six of the free prisoners were aboard now, Darkwood confirming that he had sufficient pressure and temperature, had sufficient RPMs.
Everyone is aboard! We can use the energy rifles and...
Don't engage a target once we're off the ground unless you have to. We need to get away, not wreak devastation.
Darkwood changed pitch and increased main rotor speed. The machine started airborne, sweeping upward with all the perceived grace of a giant rock with stubby wings. But they were up. Darkwood throttled out still more, climbing and slowly accelerating. He saw something over the horizon and his heart nearly stopped. But the light pattern, as he realized in the next second, originated from a fixed-wing aircraft. Not even Eden security forces would be stupid enough to send a fixed-wing fighter aircraft, because it could do nothing except bomb and strafe a ground-based target, and there had been no time for the security forces to get a fighter scrambled. His eyes still on the horizon for gunships, Darkwood praying all the while he wouldn't see one, he turned the chopper toward the mountains north of the city. He could ditch in the snows there and get help. Darkwood operated on a big assumption, of course, that Eden City's considerable air defense system, which was designed to keep enemy aircraft from successfully reaching the city, would be essentially ineffective at preventing an aircraft from leaving. Eden City was, after all, much like a prison.
We made it! We made it!
There was another landing of a commando group, some 40 or so men strong. But John Rourke, Paul Rubenstein, and Commander Washington and his Pearl Harbor SEAL team reached the beach site on the other end of the island of Hawaii too late to intercept them. The Honolulu TAC team hadn't accompanied Rourke, Washington, and the SEALs, busily engaged instead in tracking down the unit responsible for the attack on the country day school at Sebastian's Reef. As Rourke went airborne again in one of the SEAL team helicopters, intending, along with the other chopper, to make a grid-by-grid aerial search, a radio message came in from Michael. Rourke flipped to the proper frequency.
Go ahead, Michael. Over.
Dad, there's something big going on at the university. You'll want to be in on it. Over.
What, another terrorist attack? Over.
Negative that, thank God. A briefing. All I know is it's supposed to be really important. Something to do with an impending volcanic eruption. And you'll be interested in meeting the college professor doing the briefing. His name is Rolvag. Ring a bell? Over.
This professor, if he's a descendant of Bjorn Rolvag, has a lot to live up to. I'll be there. When? Over.
In about 20 minutes. Rolvag and this other scientist, a Dr. Betty Gilder, are supposedly still assembling data. Meeting's at the University Science Center. Your pilot should know how to find it. Over.
I'll be there. See you. Out.
Rourke waited for his son Michael to sign off, then switched back to the intraship frequency. He stared at the mountains. They seemed distant right now, but under the wrong set of circumstances, they might seem all too terribly close. The repository for the cryogenic chambers in which Sarah Rourke, who was Dietrich Zimmer's son Martin's natural mother, and Colonel Wolfgang Mann slept so touchingly side by side, had been recently moved to enhance security. Greater precautions required, it was presumably felt, in the light of the imminence of warfare between Eden and the rest of the world. For the purposes of what Dietrich Zimmer intended, the new location was vastly better than the old one. Immediately upon learning of Martin's capture, Dietrich Zimmer pulled the best of the best among those who proudly wore the Sigrunen, the top men to be had from both the Sicherheitsdienst and the Sicherheitshauptamt. The only one from this former unit unavailable to him was Wilhelm Doring, since Doring had already left for his assignment in the Hawaiian Islands. In the end, however, Dietrich Zimmer had 36 superbly trained and totally dedicated officer and enlisted SS and SD personnel. They stood before him now in this small auditorium within the SS complex beneath the glacier, bounded to the southeast by the vast ice field of Great Slave Lake, to the northwest by the subglacial Mackenzie River. The very existence of this facility was known only to the SS and to each man who, because of a need to know, was told of the facility's existence. It was called simply Hafen. Dietrich Zimmer raised his eyes from the beautifully shining faces of these men and looked above them to the ceiling of the hall and the cross, which was poised to roll forward on its right-angled legs, set in white on a field of red. And behind him, set into the black marble wall, the Totenkopf, in highly raised bas-relief of finest silver, itself the symbol of purity. And now Dietrich Zimmer raised his hands palm outward, extending them from the podium as he smiled beneficently on these his stalwarts.
My fine young men, after these all too brief moments together, you will go forth on a mission of incalculable importance to Aryan destiny. You will attack the cryogenics facility in which is so obscenely called New Germany. You will find inside this heavily guarded enclosure the worst of all traitors to the Reich, Wolfgang Mann. And sleeping beside him, whore that she is, the woman who is mother to our beloved Martin, herself the wife of the greatest of all enemies of the Aryan people, John Rourke. The temptation will be great, my fine young men, to go beyond the carefully defined parameters of your mission. Do not yield to such temptation. Once your historic quest has been realized, the way will be clear for the inheritors of the power and the glory of Adolf Hitler. The way will be clear at last for the Aryan race to bring order to the chaos of this hideously mongrelized planet. As your beautiful children and devoted wives one day soon will walk in peace and in sunshine, it will be because of what you do. There will be no fear that your mothers and wives and sisters and daughters will be bestialized by their inferiors. No longer will the bastard servant dare raise hand or voice against his biological master. The dream of our glorious Führer, whose blood flows in the very veins of my son Martin, will be at last realized, and the epoch of mankind's greatest achievement will have begun. And it will flourish for thousands of years. You will soon go forth to your destiny, and the greatness that is a true Aryan Germany is in your hearts and shall be there forever and forever. Heil Hitler!
There was a mountain trail she liked to walk when she wanted to think. This property, not the house, had been her parents' property when she was a little girl, and Emma Shaw had walked this trail the day she learned her mother was dead. She'd walked it again before deciding that instead of doing police work or something else that was still today a more normal occupation for a woman, she wanted to be a Navy fighter pilot. She'd walked the trail again when Hank Walsh had asked her to marry him, and she thought she might be pregnant with his baby. She hadn't married him, and she hadn't been pregnant either. Emma Shaw, the .45 chamber empty and stuffed into the waistband of her blue jeans, her t-shirt covering its presence, walked the trail again. It wasn't a steep trail, nor was it any more or less picturesque than anywhere else in the mountains here, but it was hers. Her father had wanted to give her the property when she'd told him she wanted to build a house here, perhaps feeling sorry for her that she might end up an old maid, trying to show his love for her. But she'd purchased it from him instead, and at a fair price, too. But she'd taken his offer of simple interest. Her trail was really her trail, even to the point of being paid for.
John Rourke.
Midway along her trail's length, Emma Shaw sat on her rock. Emma loved John Rourke. The sun was setting, and she could see it a little bit from her rock, on her trail, on her portion of the mountain. By craning her neck, in the morning, she could watch the sun rise, and at dusk, watch it set. Loving John Rourke was even dumber than considering marriage to good old Hank Walsh. She just flat out hadn't loved Hank. Maybe her situation was dumber now because she was in love, and John Rourke was like no one else. He was married, and that wasn't a problem easily surmounted under ideal circumstances. That his wife lay in a coma in cryogenic freeze, never aging but with a bullet lodged inoperably in her brain, made matters even worse. Emma knew that even if she hadn't had a conscience, which she did, the situation was impossible. Add to it John's very nature, the fabric of his being. Love him, yes, but be blind to him, no.
Why isn't he pissed off?
But neither the setting sun, which shone down over her trail and her rock in long, purpling orange streaks, nor the fiery gold clouds, nor anything at all, answered her. Granted, Michael Rourke was John's son, but still in all, she thought, John could have at least been angry at the situation, if not at Michael and Natalia. So here he was, born over 650 years ago, living by his own measure. She liked that, even though it irritated her. Abandoned by the woman he loved, and faithful to a wife who was just this side of dead. But John's problems were in the real world, at least. Her problem was her own stupidity. At least now, if she became an old maid, she had a reason, pining for a love she could never have. The helicopter descended through the deepening shades of purple into darkness, landing on a grassy patch at the center of an enormous quadrangle that was the exact center of the university complex. All about the four sides stood buildings modeled in Greek Revival style. Fog rolled in from the sea, not heavy, almost ghostly, and the columns, the statuary, took on what was almost the aspect of another time and place. The rotor blade downdraft made the wisps of fog curl back upon themselves, rise, then dematerialize, ghostly seeming that way as well. Paul Rubinstein was the first to jump down, ducking needlessly beneath the swirling blades from force of habit. John Rourke just behind him. Standing well away from the chopper, Paul saw his wife, his brother-in-law, the woman who would, it seemed, someday be his sister-in-law, Natalia, and Tim Shaw and his son, Ed, both from the Honolulu TAC team, were there as well. Paul smiled to himself, wondering if these men were ever off duty. John had never seemed to be off duty, Paul reflected.
How'd that stuff work out today with helping Inspector Shaw?
Oh, it was very interesting. I got to see some really neat parts of Honolulu. And we may have gotten some leads on this man named Yuri, who's a Nazi sympathizer and a drug dealer, too, you know? It was very interesting.
Great. Sounds like you had a lot more fun than we did.
After a round of handshaking, they walked along the north edge of the quadrangle, the science hall looking like an enormously proportioned temple rising out of the fog ahead of them.
We'll be passing my car. You guys want to drop your reachers in the trunk or something?
Reachers?
1930s gangster slang for a rifle or any kind of long gun, really.
They stopped beside the trunk of Tim Shaw's unmarked police cruiser. Shaw opening it, John putting his HK-91 inside, Paul resting his MP-40 submachine gun next to it. There were several other long guns inside, as well as attaché-sized high-impact plastic cases, likely for handguns. A hardplate flak vest, a riot helmet and shield, a bullhorn, and more miscellaneous police-related gear filled out the rest of the trunk space.
Ready for anything, huh?
Well, you never know what might go down, Mr. Rubinstein. Take today, for example. We could have needed some of this gear if it had gone down differently.
Tim Shaw closed the trunk lid. They returned to the quadrangle and resumed walking toward the science building. Michael and Natalia, who hadn't gone to the car with them, stood on the steps waiting. Then they continued past Michael and Natalia and into the science building, John Rourke walking ahead of them, alone. His audience was as mixed a group as he could ever have imagined. There were government officials wearing expensively tailored business suits or understated high-fashion dresses, naval officers in their dress-white uniforms, miscellaneous civilian women in trendy miniskirts or floral print sundresses with enormous flowing skirts, police officials wearing everything from uniforms to casual sport clothes to seedy-looking street attire, the young and old, the important and their aides, who someday themselves might well be important. Personal representatives of the President of the United States, who was at Midwake, and the mayor of Honolulu and the governor of Hawaii, Her Honor and His Excellency in personal attendance. Scientists, male and female, from every discipline within the university were present too, but the scientists were in the minority. Everyone had a Sigma security clearance, and for one reason or another, a need to know. The only group not represented was the press, and that was for a very good reason. Thorn Rolvag, his palms slightly damp, gripped the sides of the rostrum.
I'm Dr. Thornton Rolvag, Regents Professor of Volcanology here at the University of Hawaii. What is said here tonight will be learned unavoidably by everyone in the islands within days at the most, perhaps only hours. But until then, I am instructed by various persons to tell you that the information I will share with you tonight cannot leave this room. After what I'm afraid will not be a very brief statement and may at times be a bit obtrusive, scientists aren't always that great at simplifying things. I'll answer any questions that I can. Being half Icelandic, perhaps I have volcanology in my blood. And the study of indigenous volcanic activity in these islands is not really all that much removed from the study of volcanoes of my ancestral homeland. There are several classifications of volcanoes, and those of Lidveldid Island and Hawaii are coincidentally of the same type. They are shield volcanoes. Shield volcanoes have an angle of slope between 3 and 8 degrees at their summit. There's almost invariably a crater with very steep walls and a flat base. Where the difference arises between the volcanoes of Iceland and those of Hawaii is, putting it simply, in size. Icelandic volcanoes range from a little over 300 feet in height to well over 3,000 feet, with base diameters correspondingly 20 times the height. Hawaiian shield volcanoes are the largest on Earth, possibly the largest that have ever been. Kilauea on Mauna Loa, for example. When one considers the portion of Mauna Loa which is underwater, it has a height 10 times greater than the largest of the Icelandic volcanoes, roughly 33,000 feet, or about 6 miles. Its base is 250 miles in diameter. Hawaiian volcanoes have an average angle of slope which is no more than 6 degrees, and the summit is most often a plateau, quite expansive. To put this into perspective, consider how the Hawaiian Islands came to be. We're all familiar with the concept of plate tectonics, how solid masses float across the Earth on a plastic-like surface of molten material. Proto-continents, Pangaea and Gondwanaland, existed at least twice in geologic history, only to break up subsequently into their separate land masses. The jigsaw puzzle was assembled, then broken apart. Some 43 million years ago, the Pacific Plate began moving in a northwesterly direction, creating the Hawaiian Ridge and the islands where we stand. The youngest of these islands, and the most geologically active, is the Big Island, Hawaii. All shield volcanoes are formed almost totally of basalts, are rich in calcium and magnesium. Although the ancient peoples of Hawaii credited the eruption to the restless feet of the goddess Pele, as scientists today, we credit eruption to something perhaps just as unpredictable as a female goddess, the movement of magma and gas beneath the Earth's surface. When too much pressure builds up, there is an eruption. For the traditionalists who may be among us, I suppose it could always be theorized that Pele causes these buildups. There are two types of lava with which we are concerned. In Hawaii, they are called Pahoho and Aha. Pahoho is fluid, moves rapidly, while Aha is much rougher textured and more violent in appearance. The temperatures below the ground can easily reach 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not warm at all when compared to the sun, where it's a balmy 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. Within the context of metallurgy, however, 2,800 degrees is considered the high-end limit for combustion heating. What lava is, then, is wildly hot liquefied metal, stating it most basically. Anything it touches, it destroys, or covers over, sealing it. Plate tectonics, of course, are responsible for a wide range of phenomena, everything from mountain building to earthquake to the crisis we now face. Dr. Betty Gilder and I, along with a staff of graduate students and in discreet consultation with other experts in the field from among the nations of the Trans-Global Alliance, have confirmed, ladies and gentlemen, that Kilauea is about to erupt in a manner unprecedented in recorded history. What this means, in part at least, is that the big island, Hawaii, must be evacuated. Those plans, I understand, are already underway, and the actual full-scale evacuation effort will begin within hours, hopefully soon enough. The evacuation will be locally announced. It will be announced on the Big Island and initial efforts begun within the next 10 minutes. Normally, ladies and gentlemen, our volcanoes could well be classified as gentle giants, capable of great destruction indeed, but in modern times, responsible for little, if any, loss of human life. That will not be the case in this instance. When Kilauea erupts, we are predicting a violent burst of gas and ash, forming a cloud which may well obscure the sun for some time. We further predict a lava flow of such proportion and violence that the plateau will sink and the slope at least partially disintegrate, thus spilling both types of lava, Pahoho and Aha, more rapidly and in greater volume than ever experienced before in a populated area. This sudden introduction of lava in such immense volume and the upthrust and subsequent collapse of the undersea portion of the mountain will precipitate tsunamis and high tides of levels and strengths significantly greater than ever experienced in these islands. Earth tremors, to include those which may be felt on the ocean floor, will be experienced as far away as the Chinese First City and Port Reno in North America. Midwake itself, as well as the Russian-American subsurface complex, largely a manufacturing area, will experience quakes. As of yet, the actual strength of these quakes cannot be predicted. You have been asked to come here, ladies and gentlemen, in order that you may be informed. I understand that each of you, in one manner or another, will be involved in the efforts, which will be required to minimize, as best as possible, the effects of this natural disaster. Now, I promise to try to answer any questions I could.
There was a flurry of hands. Rather than try to guess who was the most important, he went to the first hand he'd seen.
You, miss, in the print dress.
I'm Annie Rubenstein. I want to know if there's anything which could be done to divert the effects of the eruption, even partially. That's probably a naive question, but my science is a little behind the times.
That's actually a good question, Mrs. Rubenstein. A very good question. The lava has to go somewhere, of course, the pressure relieved. And there's been a theory for some time that with a volcano as immense as the one we're discussing here, it might indeed be possible to find a point where a lava flow might produce significantly less damage and the pressure buildup might be relieved more gradually. I can't go into all the details here, but I'd be happy to discuss the process in greater depth with you and anyone else interested at a later date. Suffice it to say, however, this is only theoretical. The basic methodology would involve utilizing high-speed torpedoes or missiles, which would be fired in series and essentially drill through the rock over one of the tube-like structures within the volcano through which lava flows. Puncture the tube, and the lava will flow out at the site of the puncture. Do this with several of the larger tubes, and it would be analogous to what would result with a human being, for example, if one suddenly diminished arterial blood flow. The eruption could essentially die.
Thorn Rolvag wondered if indeed it might work.